For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way toward salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave.
Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. In the cave with me, our favorite twin troglodytes.
Oh, gosh.
Mark Tuttle and Mr. Timothy O'Donnell.
Howdy.
Gentlemen, we're looking toward economics, and so we've brought in an expert.
Tim. At last. Yeah. At last. You don't have to put up with just Mark and I.
It's somebody that actually knows something rather than just throwing out random opinions.
We're in the cave for a reason. So they don't let us out.
Do our introductions, please.
Yeah, well, we are thrilled to invite for the first time into the Catholic Cave Professor Matthew Will from the University of Indianapolis. Welcome to the Catholic Cave.
I appreciate you having me. I'm happy to be here.
Well, fantastic. Hey, let's, for the sake of our audience, tell us a little bit about your background. Kind of where are you from? Where'd you go to school? Maybe how did you become a professor?
It's a good question because I'm actually what I would call an accidental professor.
Excellent.
I never planned to be one. I never wanted to be one. I kind of stumbled into it.
Oh, that's how this show started. Same thing.
You know, God leads us in various ways without us realizing it. And I've really realized it more recently that this was God's plan all along. My dad was in the Air Force. He was a sergeant. And so we grew up not in the best of means. My parents worked very hard. My dad had multiple jobs, actually, in addition to being in the military full time. And in fact, I was born overseas. So I'm like John McCain. You know, he was born on post in Panama. I was born on an Air Force base in Turkey.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, you can tell by my complexion. I'm definitely born in the Middle East.
And your accent gives it away, too.
Definitely. Very high Turkish accent. So, you know, when I was growing up, for me, going to college was about getting a job and making money. So,
yes. Strictly economic.
Yeah, that's what it was. You know, so I was good at math. So I said, what is the one field that has the highest income for someone graduating from college? And it was actuarial sciences. My degree is in actuarial sciences.
There you go.
And I quickly learned I did not like that.
Oh.
The actuaries of the world did not have the most dynamic personalities of the individuals I would run into.
A little boring.
Well, you know what?
For you.
My friends who are actuaries would disagree with that.
Right, but, right.
You know, I have lots of actuary jokes. We'll save them for off air. But I did that for a while, and it really wasn't my cup of tea. So I switched over into finance. And pursued an MBA in finance down at Indiana University. Okay. Graduated, worked for an insurance company, switched to what's called a private equity company, if you're familiar with what private equity is. Did that for a while, and then when we started to have a family, my wife and I said we wanted to have one of us be at home with the children. And we both had very good jobs, even though we both came from very humble beginnings. And my wife was director of e-commerce at Zurich Insurance.
Oh, wow. There you go.
I was running a private equity company, a division of one at the time. And so we decided that one of us would stay home, and it was me.
Oh, jackpot. Yes. Yeah. I've always wanted to be a trophy husband.
So I was. I was Mr. Mom, if you remember the Michael Keaton movie from way back when.
I do, with much envy.
And I was, in fact, the room mother is what they called me because that's what everybody was. I was the only one that wasn't female.
Okay.
And I did that for the entire time our children were young until they actually entered kindergarten.
Okay.
But at that same time, I decided I wanted to do more. So what I did is I switched into academia. And I went to Johns Hopkins University and knocked on the door and said, hey, do you need any finance people? I'm available in the evenings, not during the day. And they said, yes, we do, because finance people are in high demand since most of them are on Wall Street. And people with my skill set were not going into academia very much. And I began teaching at Johns Hopkins. Most people kind of finish their career there, and I was blessed to begin my career at that location. And again, it wasn't a plan. I was just looking for something to do in the evenings because I was taking care of kids during the day, but not just taking care of the kids. I would go around, and I was starting to help with churches with their census data, their financial data. This was back when people in the 90s, when computers were just coming into offices. And
sure.
Not a lot of parishes had yet had computerized census information and computerized accounting systems.
And some still don't.
Well, yes. So you can imagine there's a pretty high demand.
Yeah.
And so this high demand caused me to, you know, start doing some consulting for churches. And I always had a rule because, of course, churches didn't have much money to pay me. And I said, well, since you don't have much to pay me, I'll take what you can afford, provided I can take my children with me.
And oh, smart.
So my children probably were the taken care of by every church secretary in Baltimore, because that's where we were living at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And I would go in and I would drop the children off with the church secretary, and then I would mess around with the computers in the office. And, you know, it was so funny because we'd go into some parishes and they would just have a drawer of toys for my kids' names were Henry and Catherine. And they'd have the Henry and Catherine drawer. So I would walk over to the computer and they'd just go over and pull the drawer up and all these toys would be there.
Oh, fun.
And so my children grew up around parishes who I was working with as a consultant. And then I would go and teach finance in the evenings. I was successful at Hopkins. I won Teacher of the Year while I was there.
Awesome, yeah.
And then McGraw-Hill, which is a publisher of books, mm-hmm. they came to me and said, well, if you can teach well, maybe you can help write books.
Oh, okay. Another link in the chain.
Another one. Yeah, again, a fortuitous
unexpected.
Link.
Yeah, unexpected.
Totally without planning, I started helping write textbooks. I wrote one textbook myself. And then I write supplements, which are the test bank, the instructor's manual,
parts of
chapters for international editions. And that's really what I've been doing for McGraw-Hill now for, goodness, since 2000. Oh, my. I'm going to show my age. I can't say this. For a long time.
Okay.
But that is a long journey from actuarial tables.
It is. But this was all in Baltimore. We actually, the story of how we ended up in Indianapolis is rather unique because my wife was with a company and her company was a dot-com in the dot-com era, so they went dot-bust.
Oh, many did, yes.
And so she comes home and says, well, you know, I'm out of a job here, because she had switched from Zurich to this other company. And, you know, we thought we were going to get rich because they were a pre-IPO company. They're going to go public, you know, she's going to make a lot of dot-com money.
Sure.
And they did not. So
right.
She comes home one day and says, you know what? I want to move back home. I want to go to Indiana. Because her parents are from Jasper. My parents are from Evansville originally.
Okay, Southern, yeah.
God's country.
Exactly what we call it, Mark. We are in God's country.
Right.
So we decided to move back to as close as we could get to God's country. So Indianapolis is close enough. So we ended up in Indianapolis, and my wife works at Eli Lilly, and I was fortunate enough to have multiple opportunities, and I chose to work at University of Indianapolis. I love it. It's a great program we have there in the School of Business. Our finance program is outstanding. Get to teach. The research is not our primary concern, but it's teaching students and imparting to them the knowledge they need to pursue a career. And so that's kind of the long route. I ended up to being a professor. I did eventually get my doctorate, in fact, at Anderson University.
Okay, just north of here.
Yeah, another great institution.
Yes.
And in fact, the reason I did that is Anderson had a faith integration component in their doctoral program. And so I was able to spend my time in my doctoral program combining finance with my faith. And I found that one of the most valuable things that I had ever done in my entire life was that faith integration into my doctoral studies. And a lot of what I do now when I speak, for example, I spoke recently to the Catholic Business Exchange, and I spoke to the Catholic Medical Association not too long ago. And I love those kind of speeches because I'm allowed to integrate my faith deeply into the conversation, where on a daily basis in class, it's not really
You're focusing on other things, and right, they're not always looking for in a non-religious school for the professor to go into their, you know, religious beliefs. But
well, it's not even my religious beliefs. Before we even started recording the show here, we're talking about, you know, economics and faith, and so my specialty is faith integration into finance.
Tell us about that. What does that mean? Unpack that for us.
Well, you know, there's a lot of misperceptions out there relative to this. And so before we get into the details of some of that, just, you know, what I did at Anderson when I was studying my doctorate is I was able to take every course that I had, whether it's marketing or operations or technology or finance, of course, which is my field, and learn about church teaching. Learn about what other faiths think, because obviously that's a Church of God institution, so Catholicism isn't central to what they do. But I have all these other faiths, and they were, you know, again, it was a faith integration program. So I was able to learn from them, learn from my own faith. I was doing doctoral work, which said, go study, because that's what you do when you're doing your doctorate. It says, go study. So I went and studied my religion as it pertains to economics. So when I graduated, I felt very blessed because I was able to allow, I was allowed to dedicate time to learning about my faith in the context of my vocation. And I believe that my vocation is a very deeply spiritual thing. People think, oh, finance, Wall Street, that's not spiritual. That's because they don't fully understand the faith and moral component of Wall Street and finance.
Yeah, I think in a lot of people's mind, there's almost, you know, we talk about the strict separation of church and state. Well, there seems to be a strict separation in most people's minds of faith and finance. And, you know, I go to church on Sunday, I pray, I've got my religious sphere of life, and my finances don't seem to enter into that. You know, the interplay there of faith and finance, they just seem like two different worlds that we kind of inhabit at different times. So tell us a little bit about how those are much more integrated than most of us even realize.
Well, you know, to the point you said about people thinking they're separate, you know, we as Catholics could actually learn quite a bit from our fellow Christians in the Protestant denominations because, you know, Weber and his, you know, Protestant work ethic, you know, they actually said that you are glorifying God when you work, and the work you do should be to glorify God. And there's nothing wrong with gaining wealth. It's more a question of how you, what you do with that wealth. And that's where it starts dovetailing with Catholic teaching. And that our teaching is not about not obtaining wealth. It's more of how do you, what do you do with it? You know, how do you fit through the eye of the needle? And it is your ability to unburden yourself in order to get into heaven.
Yeah, I'm wondering too, as we, well, we're going to, actually, I'm wondering why we're not taking a break yet. Well, we are. We are going to take a break right now. And what I want to do is remind our audience that we brought into the Catholic Cave Professor Matthew Will. He's a professor of finance at the University of Indianapolis. We're talking all things faith and business related. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy.
Think of all the media our young people are exposed to today. MTV, movies, what passes for entertainment on TV, song lyrics that are questionable or worse. Where do they hear the message that it's okay to be chaste and modest, or that it's not crazy to practice their faith, or to believe in a God who loves them and can forgive them no matter what they do? Catholic Radio is the answer. Be sure to tell your friends and relatives about Catholic Radio Indy.
Listening to this radio was really like the jump start of me getting to know Jesus.
This is the station that led me to Christ.
Catholic Radio Indy.
You know us as Catholic Radio Indy, but we're so much more than just radio. We're a website, CatholicRadioIndy.org, with access to great Catholic resources, including podcasts of all our local programming, podcasts that have been downloaded from all 50 states and over 40 countries on 6 continents. Yes, we are Catholic Radio Indy, but thanks to your support, we're taking the gospel of Christ to the ends of the earth. Catholic Radio Indy and CatholicRadioIndy.org.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave, and in the cave still is Mark Tuttle, myself, Tim O'Donnell, and our special guest, Professor Matthew Will of the University of Indianapolis. And Professor Will, we were talking about the integration of faith and business, and there's a lot of misunderstandings out there. Help us understand, when you talk about integrating faith into your vocation as a professor of finance, finance overall, business, the commercial society, well, help us understand that. Help us see how those might be compatible and not an oppositional as is often brought up in conversations.
Well, you know, let me start with a very important point that people have a misperception of. And that is that people think that the Catholic Church has some very vast left-wing social agenda that must be implemented through government.
You're absolutely right.
The social justice teachings of the church.
Right,
you hear that phrase all. Well, it's the social justice teachings.
And the social justice teaching is extremely important. You know, probably, in my opinion, the seminal work in the Catholic Church from both social justice and finance is Rerum Novarum.
Oh, absolutely.
Yep. You know, 1891. Okay. When the Pope issued this, and by the way, this was such an important encyclical that, you know, Pope Pope now, Saint Pope John Paul II. I have a tough time saying the saint part, even though he is, because I had the opportunity to meet him twice during his life.
Oh, wow.
And
you might be a third degree relic then. I better.
No, well, I don't know that we ever shook hands. And my distance was, one of them was a few feet, the other one was a few yards. But, he wrote an encyclical on the 100th anniversary of Rerum Novarum. That's how important this document was, that a saint wrote an encyclical to commemorate the 100th anniversary of another encyclical.
Right.
It's that important. And Catholics need to, and especially my my left-leaning Catholic friends, need to remember that the Catholic teaching does not ban capitalism or democracy or all these things, or even monarchies. It bans one thing and one thing only. It bans socialism. Socialism is explicitly refuted in Rerum Novarum. It was reinforced by Pope Benedict and John Paul in encyclicals they wrote, which said that socialism was not a permitted form of system.
And why is that? I mean, what's the central principle of socialism that falls afield of Catholic teaching?
Okay, that's a great question. And if you permit me, and this is, I used to have a radio show, and the cardinal sin is you never read on the radio. May I have an indulgence here to break the cardinal sin?
Oh, absolutely.
Tim reads all the time. That's why you don't hear him talking. He's over there in the corner with a book. So.
I have the catechism right here if we need it.
The Rerum Novarum says, and this is where it's banning socialism. It says, it is clear, it's quote, it is clear that the main tenet of socialism, the community of goods, must be utterly rejected. The first and foremost fundamental principle, therefore, if one were to undertake to alleviate the condition of the masses, must be the inviolability of private property. Socialists, to answer your question, Mark, socialists, therefore, by endeavoring to transfer the possessions of the individual to the community, strike at the interest of every wage earner, since it deprives them of the liberty of disposing of his own wages. End quote. Let me tell you why that is so vital. Because you don't get into heaven based on how well the government gives away your money after it's taxed. You get into heaven by how well you give away your own money. This is not a communal redemption. That's why the church doesn't permit communal penance, because you cannot be, except in extraordinary circumstances. If I were to say as a business person, the Catholic Church has a mission statement. You know what the mission statement is? Save souls.
Right, right.
That's why we're here. We're here to get everybody into heaven. Adam and Eve kind of messed it up. Christ came back and opened it back up for us. And now it's our job to get people into heaven. That's our number one goal. We have no other objective. And it is not based on how well the government feeds the hungry or clothes the naked or houses the people that are homeless. How well the government does that has nothing to do with your individual soul. If you live in a country that has all these great social services, I think it's harder for you to get into heaven. Because as it says in this encyclical, it deprives you of the liberty of disposing of your own wages.
Right. You've delegated it away. You've delegated your opportunity to do corporal works of mercy to someone else.
And it's distorted the meaning of those works. We look at those works as charitable works. And charity is an act of love. It's an act of establishing a relationship with another person for the good of their soul. And when you give that away to the community, you've kind of given away any idea of a relationship with that person.
You've given away also your chance to get into heaven. Because you said, charity and love and truth. You just said it. Remember, Pope Benedict wrote the encyclical, Charity and Truth. And in that, he talked about the main theme of that was, you must be charitable. It is your obligation. The entire theme was what you must do. Nowhere in there did he talk about the government giving away your stuff. The entire encyclical was you and how you give away your stuff and how you're going to redeem your soul. And you must be charitable. And charitable is love. And that is the truth of what God teaches us. And we are totally missing the boat if we believe that socialism is a solution. In fact, the church has said explicitly, and then St. Pope John Paul II said it explicitly again, Pope Benedict said it explicitly again, that socialism must be rejected And they all said it for the same reason, because you get into heaven by what you do yourself as a charitable person.
So what makes it so attractive then? It keeps it's over 100 years old now, that, you know, the encyclical. So clearly 100 years ago it had some prominence and needed to be addressed. Why do you think it's continues to sort of rear its head, this beast of socialism, and why people find it so attractive?
Well, I think there's two reasons. And one of them is what I call outcomes, and the other one is the themes in Rerum Novarum, because Rerum Novarum is the social teaching of the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. It's where it all started. And the liberals read it, and they don't read the part I just told you.
Right. Delete, delete, delete.
Yes. They read the rest of it. And the rest of it, which is also wonderful, talks about how wage earners must be given rights, and how the government has a duty to help the downtrodden. But the people on the left who read this, they then say, oh, well, the only way to help the downtrodden is to have the government step in. No. This, in fact, I got to tell them, they may not like this, but if you read the entire encyclical, it makes your life very, very difficult. Because first you must reject the government and socialism. Then it is on your shoulders, every individual, to do the work to be charitable, to help people. And they talk about workers' rights and workers' conditions. And they even talk about free trade in there. And how one of the things that concerns me about the United States right now is our trade policy under President Trump has been mostly, until recently, he's signed some pretty good trade agreements, actually, this new North American free, well, it's called the USMCA, I think is an excellent trade agreement. But prior to then, he was actually violating a lot of the encyclical rules that require you to not be nationalistic in your policies towards other countries. The encyclicals say that. Wow, that makes it hard for us. So how are we going to take care of our poor, be charitable to other people, not let the government take over and run everything? And the second point, which is outcomes. So while Rerum Novarum is this massive document on doing good for other people, and it tells you what you have to do, the church does not say you get into heaven by outcomes. You do not get into heaven by the number of people that are starving. So if there are fewer people, there's not like a little accounting book.
Right.
It says, well, fewer people are starving, so we all get into heaven. No, you could actually not save a single person in your life and still get into heaven so long as you dedicated your entire life to saving them.
You know, that's one of the quotes from Mother Teresa that in some ways it irritates me because it's not outcome-based. And I tend to fall into that trap. But that God calls us to be faithful, not successful, which, you know, that just cuts against the grain. But it's exactly what you were saying. We don't get into heaven based on the outcomes. It's our own faithfulness in responding to God's call.
And why is it that when a priest is by themselves in the middle of nowhere that they still say Mass, even if no one's around? Because it is the individual praising of God as to why they do that. It's not because they're doing it for the community. And people forget that. We have this perception, especially in the United States, that somehow there is communal salvation. And there is not communal salvation. There is individual salvation. And we forget that in the Catholic Church.
See, and I've been relying on Tim's good works to get me into heaven all this time. Cool. So
you need another plan.
Well, I will pray for you, Mark. I'm gonna pray for you. Right. You know, people that are listening may think, well, okay, he's knocking the liberals, and the conservatives are jumping up in joy. Okay, now let me offend the conservatives.
Okay, good. Don't leave anybody out.
And that was Pope Paul VI in 1967. He wrote an encyclical. And my Latin is terrible. Populorum Progressio. So I'm sure there's some Latin students out there who are going to say, he said that wrong. And I'm going to quote again, because this is very important. He said, quote, God intended the earth and everything in it for the use of all human beings and peoples, created goods that flow fairly to all, and all other rights, whatever they may be, including the rights of property and free trade, are to be subordinate to this principle. They should in no way hinder it. In fact, they should actively facilitate its implementation, end quote. Now, a lot of people think, well, that just contradicts what I previously said. It doesn't, because the assumption, it contradicts it if you read what I just said as if that is a mandate to government. But if you read it as a mandate to the individual, then it makes sense.
Right.
In fact, it fits perfectly into Rerum Novarum that says that the government cannot distribute your goods for you. It is your obligation that you must distribute your goods. Now, if you read what I just said in the context of you as an individual, you, God intended everything you have to be shared with everyone else. And that even your right of private property must be subordinate to you giving your stuff away.
Yeah, you put those two principles together and you come quickly to the concept of stewardship.
No, you're 100% correct. I mean, stewardship is where it's at. And I, you know, to make it in simplistic terms, I like to say to folks, this is what God wants you to do. God wants you to work hard, be as rich and filthy rich as you possibly can, and then give everything away.
Right.
That's ultimately the goal.
Yeah, you're talking about making the most of your talents and your gifts, mm-hmm. And then reaping what? Harvesting the fruits of your labor, and then putting the fruits of your labor at the service of our brothers and sisters.
Well, we're coming up on a time for another break, but when we come back from the break, I want to talk a little bit about what this leads to, and that is inequality. And how inequality and our how that's a challenge and how we can meet that challenge, or perhaps it's not a challenge. So we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio. We'll be right back.
Have you ever thought about joining the Catholic Church? Have you just wanted to explore the Catholic faith? All you need to do is call your local Catholic Church for more information. We are always happy to help you in your journey to discover and learn more about the Catholic faith. We have classes that are almost year-round, and the classes and information sessions do not involve making a commitment, and there is no pressure to join. Please call your local Catholic parish for more information today and start the journey of one day possibly becoming Catholic as well. God bless.
Listening to this radio was really like the jump start of me getting to know Jesus.
This is the station that led me to Christ.
Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell, and we are talking with
Matt Will.
Professor Matt Will. We are talking with Professor Matt Will.
We're Matthew and Mark. You know, yeah. We're in the Bible here.
Right. I'm only a little letter at the end, St. Paul's letters to Timothy.
Well, we are talking with Professor Matt Will about economics. And right as we came to the break, we were talking about the concept of stewardship and how God's plan to a certain extent can be summed up that God wants us to make the most of the gifts that he's given us so that we can distribute those gifts and give those gifts away to everybody else. But then the question comes up, that's going to lead to inequality. You know, the inevitability of inequality starts to rear its head. And so the question is, what do you do with that inequality? Is that necessarily a bad thing? Is that a good thing? Is that part of God's design that there are going to be inequalities and God's going to use that to bless everybody? Or is that something we as the church are supposed to address and make sure that there isn't this massive amount of inequality out there?
Well, before I get into the inequality, let me just finish up on the topic of, you know, what I said right before the break, which was, I believe that what God wants us to do is use our talents, amass wealth. I mean, you can say that, you know, I don't know that he doesn't say amass wealth, but he says, you know, plant the seed and take your talents and multiply your talents. But I can translate that into amass wealth and then give it away. And the reason I think that's so important is because it is not as easy as people think. Because if you become an extremely wealthy person worth billions and billions of dollars, it is not easy to give it all away. Fitting through the eye of the needle, which in the parable, is really relieving your burden, taking everything off that you have and giving to someone else and becoming poor again. You find a single rich person in this world that's ever done that. It is not an easy thing to do.
Right.
It brings to mind that movie Brewster's Millions. Once again, I'm dating myself, but an 80s movie where it was exactly that. The guy inherited $1 million, but in order to inherit an even larger amount, he had to give it all away within, I think, a month. And so through this process of giving away all this wealth, he learned humility. He learned humanity. He learned compassion. And so he kind of became more human by giving the wealth away, and then proved his worthiness to be able to be a steward of what he was going to inherit otherwise.
But let me give you a modern day example, and I think you know Bill and Melinda Gates are fairly decent people. Okay, they're very charitable, but when they're giving away their wealth, they're still they still have plenty of billions. So
right.
Have you really shed your burden and fit through the eye of the needle when you still have billions left over? Just because you've done a lot and there's lots of good outcomes, that is not how you get to heaven. And again, I'm not judging anything about Bill and Melinda Gates, nothing whatsoever. I'm using them as an example, and which comes back to your point, Mark, which was inequality. That your question. And so now I know you're going to throw me out of the studio when I say this. That's a bad question, because the question makes an assumption of outcomes. And remember I said that's one of the biggest flaws that we have. It's not about outcomes that you get into heaven. You don't get into heaven by the number of people that are saved from poverty or the number of people that don't die in wars. You get into heaven based on what you do. And inequality, the assumption in that question is that the outcome of inequality is bad. And I would say the outcome of inequality or equality is irrelevant. I do not care what the outcome is. The outcome is pure. And for when I say secondary or third, that's even wrong. It's irrelevant. The only thing that matters is what you are doing to make and alleviate the problems of the world. And so, but we all do that. We all fall into this trap of equality and inequality. But having said that, okay, so now you're not going to throw me out of studio now, are you?
No.
Okay. Having said that, now let me say that the best way to achieve the most equality and the highest level of outcome for everybody is to not try to create equal outcomes. All the research, and let me throw off my Catholic hat and just put on my nerdy academic professor hat and tell you that the research shows that the best highest average of income and the best distribution of income, most efficient for most people getting the most wealth, consistently in history has been in those places that did not try to control outcomes and control equality. Communism is a perfect example. You look at its Soviet Union and you look at people in the middle, and I've done research on this. I've been to the Russia and talked to professors there and looked at data, and I can tell you, they had one of the most fertile grounds in the world, and people were starving during the Soviet Union era, because they had a goal of creating the perfect equal outcome. Just read Animal Farm. People don't read enough nowadays. Go back and read Animal Farm.
You can even watch a good adaptation on YouTube of Animal Farm with real animals.
Okay. Go back and read Animal Farm.
Yeah. I say read the book.
I'm talking to millennials.
Believe me, I've got millennials in my class. They need to read books.
You're too so
much,
right.
Too much technology out there feeding them these things. So I think that what you need to see is outcomes are irrelevant. You want to focus on what you're doing. And the research shows you that when you try to allow freedom, that and the market is free and the free flow of goods and ideas, and no one is monopolistically taking over you, and the government is protecting you or protecting a company from competition, that the distribution of wealth is more spread. It's when you get into like a communist environment or a socialist environment that you have this concentration of wealth. I mean, you go to India, which has enormous poverty, and it is a truly socialist country. And in that country, there are a few families that have all the wealth. They control the country. They have officially no caste system, but I can tell you, I was there in February, their caste system is alive and well. And the ability to create better wealth distribution comes from not trying to distribute the wealth. It's allowing the freedom of people to interact and create for themselves.
Why is that? Why is freedom one of the, if not the ground of conditions that we need to have, say, a society that flourishes? Why is freedom so important?
I'm a big believer in, Charles Murray, you've heard people condemn him for his book, The Bell Curve. And all he did was just make an observation that the world is basically a bell curve. That, there's mm-hmm. people that are average and there are people that are extremely on the high end and people extremely on the low end. And everything in the world is going to kind of turn out like that. This isn't Lake Wobegon where everyone's above average.
Right.
That
80-20 rule tends to hold true, right? Where, 20% of your customers give you 80% of your business, 20% of your workers give you 80% of your output, right? I mean, that's...
Well, that's not necessarily the bell curve. What I'm saying is that...
Well, no, but there's an uneven distribution of, say, talents. Well, that some people are more talented and less.
I mean, you could say that. That's not really what I'm getting at, though. What I'm getting at is if you leave inefficiencies out, government trying to control things, companies not being allowed to be monopolistic, then what will happen is you will have the highest average possible. That if you have inefficiencies, gotcha, that you'll mess that up. That you'll have these really extreme people who are in power and control and can kill the competition, you know, figuratively and literally. And that you'll have all these people on the low end because the high end will congregate. They'll take the power and aggregate it to themselves. Where if you don't have these government interventions, you don't have these inefficiencies, that the world will naturally evolve to the point where there's a relatively normal distribution. And that's what you look for. We've seen in all of history that whenever you don't have that, when you have the people trying to control the mechanisms of the economy, that the average is lower and the distribution is larger. By larger, I mean more a bigger gap between the haves and the have-nots. But when you remove those interventions, that the economy and the world comes back to a bell curve, a normal distribution.
Gotcha.
And
okay.
Just all the research shows that that's how you have your optimal outcomes.
So how do you take care of just speaking at the low end of, say, the bell curve, what does the church teach? What are your views on when should we begin to put in, say, safety nets, programs, things to help the weak, the vulnerable, or assist people who are maybe facing a challenging period in their life?
You know, that is a really difficult question because there's lots of research on both sides of that one. And mm-hmm. By the way, let me answer it first. The church does not prescribe a specific outcome.
Right, right.
I mean, that is very, very important for people to remember, that the church does not step in and tell you what they want the outcome to be. Pope Benedict, he wrote an encyclical, Caritas in Veritate. And he said, this was his quote, he says, quote, "The church does not have technical solutions to offer and does not claim to interfere in any ways in the politics of the state," end quote. And Pope Paul VI, in his, I mentioned the one earlier, Populorum Progressio, he said, quote, "The church has no desire to be involved in the political activities of any nation," end quote. And so right away, these popes are always saying, the popes are always saying, no, we're not going to get involved in technical solutions. And your question, Tim, is kind of like, what's the technical solution?
Yeah, right.
The church doesn't tell us. So guess what? Another one of those things, the church is throwing it back in our face saying, here you go, fix it.
Right.
Yeah. And so it's our job, and I'll have an opinion. My opinion is not based on church teaching. It's based on my personal research. And I think that the church, the country should provide a safety net. I believe that there is a minimal level of income. I think the best way to do it would be through a voucher system and negative income taxes, where, you know, if you are a low income person, you get a tax credit. And then as you make income, those tax credits are slowly diminished. You know, some people would say that's maybe a little bit too liberal to have the government providing some subsistence level. That's my opinion. People that are maybe a bit less government oriented would say, look, government should do nothing. It should be up to private charities. And there's nothing wrong with that opinion. I do not dispute it. And I have in my life consistently thought, well, maybe that is the best approach. But then I have found that on occasion people aren't as charitable as we may want them to be. So I think providing a safety net is a good thing, so long as that safety net doesn't get so big that it gets down to depriving individuals of their choices, like we said, can't happen, which gets to a point you mentioned at the break, which is subsidiarity, that we must always keep thinking that we must try to get this down to the lowest, or not the lowest, but the level closest to the individual.
There we go.
And nothing is closer than me helping a person in need. That's the ultimate subsidiarity. But maybe the community, maybe St. Vincent de Paul, maybe my township or my city, you know. But then when you get to, like, healthcare, I'll just pick on healthcare just to get everybody mad at me. 17% of our economy controlled by the government. I don't care how you draw the gray line of subsidiarity. The national government owning 17% of the economy is not anywhere in that definition. And the government has no role, from a Catholic perspective, in running the healthcare system of our country.
Yeah. Why is that?
Why does they have the from a Catholic teaching? Mm-hmm. Do they not? Because of subsidiarity, mm-hmm. right there. I mean, when you think
they sort of abrogated the power, right, up to a level far removed, and yes. and yeah. it's that being. It's that distance, right?
Yes,
that can create the problem.
Right, right. They're no longer in touch with mm-hmm. the, you know the people that they're serving ultimately. So correct. You know the patients that need the care, mm-hmm. as the phrase goes, that really is best left to the patient and the doctor. Well, once you get a government bureaucracy involved, it's no longer just between the patient and his doctor.
It is not, and you know Tim's point was good. The distance is so large that you have some person sitting in an office in Washington, D.C., telling a person in, you know, Greenwood, Indiana, what medical procedure they should be allowed to have, and their doctor and the person sitting across from them has no say-so in the matter.
Yeah, and how much they're going to be reimbursed for it, too. Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? We're up against another break, so we've been listening to the Catholic Cave here on Catholic Radio Indy with our special guest, Professor Matthew Will from the University of Indianapolis. Stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
You know us as Catholic Radio Indy, but we're so much more than just radio. We're a voice for the church that's seldom heard in our chaotic world. We're confirmation for the strong of faith and encouragement and answers for those in doubt. We're there to rejoice with your triumphs and to be a voice of consolation through the dark times. We're a voice for vocations and proudly pro-life. We are Catholic Radio Indy and CatholicRadioIndy.org.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm still Timothy O'Donnell, and in the cave, we still have the great pleasure of Professor Matthew Will from the University of Indianapolis. We've been talking about Catholic social teaching. We've been talking about economics, business overall. I think we're in this last segment, one of the things we're going to take up now, talk about maybe some specific policies as it pertains to, say, the business world. And one of them that I'm interested in that we maybe haven't touched on yet, though, is tariffs. The role, what do you think of tariffs? Good idea, bad idea?
You know, the tough part about that question is the tariff itself a bad thing? And the answer is yes. Is it used as a tactic to ultimately achieve free trade? It appears so recently. Mm-hmm. You know, I've been on record as saying that I do not agree with the tactics of the president and his approach to free trade. NAFTA was not a good agreement, but it was, NAFTA was a good agreement. It wasn't a bad agreement, as he said. It wasn't terrible. Catholic teaching tells us not to be nationalistic in our trade policy. Our encyclicals are very explicit about not turning towards nationalism when we're trying to deal with other countries, because to do so, since we are the bigger party in these transactions, we are therefore being abusive to the other countries in that process. That being said, the new agreement, the USMCA, is much better than NAFTA.
What makes it better?
Well, there are pages and pages of tariffs. In fact, there's 285 pages. How do I know that? Because I'm a nerd who reads these things.
That's why you're in the game, because I haven't read it yet.
And when I looked at that, so I was looking at the USMCA, and I'm looking at the exhibit on tariffs, and there's 285 pages, and there's all these zeros. And I'm going down the list, and, you know, it's things like, you know, the metal holder of the eraser on pencils. You know, it's like that microscopic in there.
Okay.
And the tariffs have been, you know, 50%, 100%, 20%. They're pretty substantial. And I'm looking through this list, and it's all zeros. I thought, oh, this must be a typo, because I've read NAFTA, and NAFTA had hundreds of pages with lots and lots of tariffs on every microscopic product you can think of. And so I went to another website to download another copy, and it too said zero. And I did some more research and found out, in fact, they're zero. We actually have, other than some few exceptions like dairy, we have, with Canada and Mexico, a true free trade agreement.
Because there's no tariffs on almost everything that we're going to be engaged in commerce with.
And it's even better than that, because one of the big problems with international trade is government subsidies. Because when the government subsidizes something for an industry, that gives that industry an unfair advantage over the competing industry in the other country. And Canada specifically has a strong track record of subsidizing certain powerful industries within Canada.
Is it like agriculture for Canada? Is that one of them?
Dairy is their biggest one.
Sure.
But yes, it's agriculture, especially Mexico, very much into agriculture. Mm-hmm. But anybody with political influence, whether you're doing minerals or agriculture or manufacturing, This agreement bans subsidies. So anything that is traded between the United States and Mexico and Canada cannot be subsidized by their governments.
That's incredible, because that's, I don't think that's ever happened in human history.
I cannot recall anywhere that happening. Now, there are exceptions, such as a dairy, and they can subsidize industries that do not trade with the United States. But they also have to adhere to our environmental standards. Again, these are for products that come into the United States. Mm-hmm. They can be abusive to their environment so long as it's not dealing with us.
Right.
I wish they wouldn't be.
Right.
But they can.
But it's not controlled by the document, the USMCA.
Correct. And this is where, you know, I will admit, you know, and as Catholics, we have to admit when we're wrong. And I will humbly say that I was wrong. I was always publicly speaking poorly about Trump's approach to trade, that I did not like what he was doing in this respect. Lo and behold, the agreement that we get is almost ideal.
Wow, that's great.
I have to give him credit. He pulled this one off.
Where do you see our relations with China going? Because obviously there's tariffs and talk of trade wars. How do you think that might get resolved? Or what do you think is going to transpire there over the next, say, 12 to 24 months?
You know, I'd say one of the most the most common question I get is forecasting the future.
Which is precarious.
Yeah. And I will tell you that the most common response I give is I can't.
Right. Right.
I would not have forecasted that the president would have pulled off this agreement with Canada and Mexico. I could not have forecasted what was going to happen in which is outside my field, though, which is with North Korea. I mean, who knew what was going to happen there? I was shocked when the European Union and the president announced a framework, not an agreement, but a framework, meaning something they're going to work towards, a zero tariff trade agreement with Europe.
That would be incredible.
When they came up with that a couple months ago, I about fell out of my seat. I was shocked as well. This would be truly a free trade agreement. NAFTA was not truly a free trade agreement. It was a good agreement, but not a truly free trade agreement. And I was not a fan of the president pulling out of the TPP. I believe I've read that, and I believe that it is a decent trade agreement. It was designed as a block of organized people so that they can compete with China. I don't know what his plans are in that. Maybe he'll come back to the table with it, pull off another Mexico deal. I don't know. But I would say the president's done a pretty good job on trade, despite my and very vocal disagreements with how he was approaching it.
Yeah. Where would, turning the topic into our conversation, a little different topic, you're very well read on Catholic social teaching, Catholic teaching overall. If someone were to get started, someone out there thinking about a vocation in business, they're a Catholic or are interested in the Catholic faith, what are some suggestions that you have about how one might begin to learn more about what it means to be a Catholic in a business setting or a business profession?
Well, first of all, I appreciate the kind words, and they may be maybe a little bit over generous. I don't know that I'm that well read. I focus on church teaching as it pertains to business and economics. So I do, you know, try my best to learn those areas. And then, of course, in my personal faith, I feel obligated to read things like the Catechism of the Catholic Church, the Code of Canon Law. You know, when that came out in the 80s, you know, I went out and bought a copy of the side-by-side Latin English. I don't know why, because I can't read the side of Latin. But I definitely read that. And, you know, the documents of Vatican II, I've, you know, spent time in college reading those. So I try my best to keep up. But, you know, if someone wants to get into this, you better be good at reading. You just need to sit down and read. And the Catechism is a good place to start. I think Rerum Novarum is the first place I would go.
Okay, sure.
Pope John Paul had a number of encyclicals on the worker, on the 100th anniversary. I believe those are good pieces to start. You know, but I would focus on Catholic encyclicals. And here's why. The bishops, for example, the bishops put out an economic letter in the 80s. The United States bishops did. And in the beginning, you got to remember, bishop letters and frameworks, because they do a lot of those. Mm-hmm. Those are opinions. They're opinions of the bishops' conferences in the respective countries. They are not official Catholic teaching. Now, they contain official Catholic teaching. They may quote an encyclical or the catechism or something like that. But in the document itself is not. And when the bishops of the United States wrote a document called Economic Justice for All in the 80s, they sent it to the Vatican because the Vatican has to approve some of these things. And the Vatican believed that the document had so much opinion that it could confuse the laity that they required that the beginning of the document have a paragraph that says this document is not morally binding upon Catholics, and that the statements contained in this document are the opinion of the bishops of the United States Catholic Conference.
Oh, a disclaimer. That's how concerned they were.
Yes. Now, I don't know if they were concerned. I mean, that's my phrase and your phrase. But,
sure.
But they did require a disclaimer, which was rarely novel for someone to have to put that in at the time. So from my perspective, you just got to be careful about reading those documents. Now, you know, the Archbishop may get mad at me for saying that, and I apologize to him because I don't mean to disparage the teachings of bishops, because that's their number one role, is moral teaching.
Right.
And people should have complete deference. You know, in the Crossing the Threshold of Hope, Pope John Paul II wrote, you know, to be not afraid. And what he was saying to people is you should not be afraid to accept the teachings of the church, even if you don't fully understand them or agree with them. And we need to accept the moral teachings as given to us by our bishop, you know, Archbishop Thompson. And I have complete and 100% deference to him in matters of faith and morals. The opinions of conferences, however, are often split votes.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, this
and they're also reflecting prudential judgments too, right? About so the doctrinal framework is there, right? That we always want to give our full assent to.
Mm-hmm.
But then they're also in an effort to be helpful to us, the laity, and our society. They are at times speculating a little bit, using prudential judgment about what might be some of the means about how we might achieve the goals or ends that we're after, so that we do have some practical advice from our bishops.
But you know, those advice, sometimes those means, they're just not right. You know,
that can be the case too.
Well, right. The bishops provided a framework for healthcare. And in fact, that framework was pretty much used in the Affordable Care Act. And as we have learned, that framework is extremely anti-Catholic.
Yes.
You know, we've had all those lawsuits and the mandates that Catholic institutions provide medical services that are in violation, direct violation of our faith, starting with Humanae Vitae and everything in between. And so that's where I would, you know, if I were counsel to the bishops' conferences, I would say, be very careful. Go back to what Pope Paul VI said and what Pope Benedict said when they said, do not offer technical solutions to politicians. I think those encyclicals are words of wisdom that we should live by.
Right. Amen to that. Well, you know what? We're going to about be done with the program here in just a few short minutes. Well, so tell us, Professor Will, what are some of your current projects that you're working on? What do you have lined up down the road? How can people stay in touch with what you're currently doing and some of the things that you're up to?
Well, first of all, I would highly encourage you to follow me on Twitter, at Dr. Matt Will. That's at Dr. Matt Will. And, you know, you can take a look at what I'm tweeting and respond to it. And,
okay.
You know, I do my best to provide some valuable information on occasion. You know, I'm a finance professor at the University of Indianapolis. I enjoy this kind of show because it's not common that I get to talk about my faith and my vocation as a finance professor. But we're doing great things at the University of Indianapolis. We just started a finance lab. We will be the first school, when we finally get it up and running, to have a Bloomberg lab, which people in the world of finance will be shocked to hear that, because no one in Indianapolis has one. We will have a Bloomberg lab where our students can get Bloomberg certified.
Oh, wow.
They manage money. They have a real money, a portfolio where they buy and sell stocks. I'm telling you, it's our school of business is just, I'm so honored to be part of the school of business at the University of Indianapolis, because we are just on the cutting edge of practical education for people that are going to be experts in the field.
Well, that's fantastic. Well, I got to thank you for coming into the Catholic Cave. It's been a fascinating program. I can't wait to have you back. Thanks again, Professor Matt Will, University of Indianapolis. God bless.
And that is all the time we have for the Catholic Cave for today. Until next time, may God bless.
The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at catholicradioindy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to kent@catholicradioindy.org or by calling 317-870-8400. Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at catholicradioindy.org.